Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hi, friends. It's me, Justin Robert Young, back again.
And Brian Brushwood.
The times changed. It was a different time yesterday, and now it's a new time. That was a weird moment, because for the first time, I didn't even know it. I just went through my day not realizing I'd been granted an extra hour, because all my devices, I never saw a conflicting clock anywhere.
I was so proud of myself because I felt like I woke up an hour early. I'm like, man, I'm well rested. I get up and I go over to go get my donut, my Diet Coke, sit down to write in the morning. I'm like, yeah, this is really good. I'm like an hour. And then I'm like, wait a second. There was a time change that just happened around me.
Oh,
clever. Well, boys, it's time for our Halloween-themed episode on this November 1st.
On this All Saints Day, we celebrate by living in the past.
Yes.
I think maybe my favorite party I ever threw was, it was like a weekend where Halloween fell on a Friday. So I threw a Saturday party that was just, it was value day. Just get one more day's use out of that costume.
Get the candy half price.
Sure.
So yeah. We had a kind of an interesting space thing happen around Halloween. Just in case you were wondering, the universe is scary and it's constantly trying to frighten us when it's not trying to kill us. Did you guys see a comet Skullface?
No, I totally missed this.
Skull-faced comet hurtled by the Earth around Halloween and apparently did not steal our souls.
Oh, my God. It does look like a skull. It's a top half of a skull with kind of a lopsided eyes. Wow, that's horrific.
It does look like in very crude animation that its eyebrows, or where its skull eyebrows would be, are like furrowed up in the worried position.
Oh, I see that. He's just like, is that Earth? I'm getting awful close there, boss.
It's 2,000 feet in diameter.
What would that do if it had a direct impact? Would that be an extinction level event, you think?
I think if you were underneath it.
But I mean, would we survive a 2,000 foot wide comet?
Yeah, I think we'd survive. It depends on philosophy, but that's survivable, I think, you know?
What's that going to boil down to after the atmosphere?
What's that?
What's that going to boil down to after, coming through the atmosphere and everything?
Oh, what's that going to boil down to? It's not going to boil down that much. Going through the atmosphere.
Well, especially if it's on a direct course. Man, now I'm going to have to look up. Which are you more scared of? Being hit by a comet or asteroid or a gamma burst in our local area? Because a gamma ray burst would fry half the planet and irradiate the other half where they would die.
Well, we look at different extinction level events and stuff, you know, we find that these things are much more common. And, you know, the biggest thing, or biggest threats actually probably is for really impacting short term is volcanoes. Was it like Tabaro or whatever, like 70,000 years ago, there was a volcano thing that, you know, pretty much did a pretty good job of shutting down life on our planet for, you know, a couple of years. I mean, things survived, but it was a major extinction level event within human lifetime that almost wiped us off the planet. And so if you start looking at some of these volcanic events, and we've seen that in recent times, mid-19th century volcano, you know, when you had Krakatoa, and you've had these other events that go off that just are way more devastating than anything. And these are very short term. You know, you look in Pompeii on forward, there have been a lot of those events that and if they happen around the world in places like you don't know or aren't, it has happened, you don't know why all of a sudden everything got cold and why crops are shutting down. We've never lost life because things getting hotter. It's always because things get colder, and volcanoes are good at causing that.
So let me ask you this. Is part of what we would consider our modern civilization partly proofed for things like that because we have been around long enough to settle in areas where those issues would possibly not impact us as much? Like, or are we just constantly playing with a loaded gun if we are anywhere near a volcano.
Well, the problem is that we, you know, when we go back to the major extinction event 65 million years ago, and one of the things we think is possible that the asteroid impact, the meteorite, when it actually hit, may have triggered volcanic events. And that was a global event that then, you know, it was at one, the impact was bad, and then all of a sudden you had all the seismic activity that got set off. So you don't, these things aren't, it's not just the people immediately around it, is when these volcanoes go off, you're sending out plumes of ash that spread throughout the entire atmosphere and start to reduce the sunlight hitting the Earth a few percent. And that's all that it takes to cause big problems. Remember when the Icelandic volcano, you know, Chiwetel Ejiofor or whatever, he's a fantastic actor, by the way.
I got it.
Can't even pronounce the last name. But anyhow, when that thing, like, it shut down air traffic in the North Atlantic for a while. These things are...
Yeah, the volcanologists on television telling you about volcanoes.
So do you think, let's say we knew we were going to get some kind of big impact or a volcano. Let's say a volcano goes off and we know we're looking at enough ash, you know, however many people die or an island explodes or whatever. We know we're looking at 5 years, a decade of reduced sunlight. What can we do? Is it worth throwing up giant reflectors to point more sunlight at Earth? Is it worth painting everything? Do we pump in greenhouse gases on purpose? Do we do anything? Do we just sit there and realize there's nothing we can do?
I think the short term, like if you were trying to figure out like sort of a big geo fix towards that, is I would presume that the one thing that would bring it down would be precipitation. So if you could figure out ways to increase rainfall to bring that down. And that's, you know,
scrub the ash out of the sky, you're saying.
Yeah. You know, and one of the things that gets lost when we talk about like Arctic melt or Greenland ice melt is there's a lot of attention focused on CO2 and what that contributes to the atmosphere. But just as big or perhaps a bigger effect actually has to do with coal dust, you know, and from, you know, you see a lot of these melting glaciers, you notice there's a fine layer of dark dust on top of them. And that comes from pollution, which then changes the albedo of that. And these can have dramatic effects on stuff. So.
Well, and I don't know if I'm remembering this correctly, but I seem to remember water vapor was orders of magnitude more potent greenhouse.
Oh yeah. In every model where we try to calculate what when they talk about runaway greenhouse effect, it basically involves some sort of premise where the moisture increases dramatically, which then affects, you know, the overall. That's what, you know, the actual amount of infrared energy that CO2 can absorb is with a very, very narrow sort of band. But the idea is that if it heats up to a certain amount, it then creates this effect, which is where you get all the variability and the debate over, which there's not supposed to be debate, but there isn't one over what CO2 does by itself, but what that other effect is. That's why we have not been able to reliably predict what would happen. You know, everybody agrees, let's not try to put up as much CO2 as we can.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
We're all on board.
Except me, Edgar CO2.
Yes. But that's, you know, just gets into all the different effects that happen. So like when you start talking about, you know, the other end of it where you have, you know, a volcano spewing out all this particulate matter in there that starts absorbing in that infrared energy, you know, and shuts down photosynthesis, you know, what can you do? Like you need light, you know, and, you know, you could get a scenario like Interstellar where, you know, they're trying to build these big, you know, greenhouses or things like that to maintain it. And you're going to want to do rapid. Our best bet is rapid genetically modified engineering, you know, is trying to come up with really, really hardy stuff. But
wow. You know, so you don't even mean like, I guess
there's got to be a white paper on this somewhere.
Well,
right?
If you want to see what this looks like, if you go look at when we talk about tundra and we talk about when you start going to the northern altitudes and you go look at the effects of the Gulf Stream and you see where you look along the coastline of Russia through Europe, it's verdant and green in places, and you can follow this Arctic line all the way around, and it's really green in some places. In some places, it's not because it just doesn't get enough sunlight. It's too dry. It's too arid. And that was a point that even maybe 15,000, 20,000 years ago, there actually was thick forests. You know, and that's how rapidly that environment has changed. You know, we look at, you know, before 8,000 years ago, 9,000 years ago, when the ice caps began to really start melting, you know, you had a very different climate up there, and you had places that were greener. You go back 100,000 years, the Eemian period, super green up there, super, super dense forest that's now nothing.
Man, I just wonder, like, right now, it seems, I don't know if you noticed, there's a bit of a discussion about how to treat the environment now that it's working pretty well. If we have an explosion and we're looking at a decade window, I can't imagine anything's going to get settled fast enough for any action to get taken. Like, it seems like they'll right around the time they stop arguing will be when the ash has cleared itself up.
Oh, no. I mean, I think a extinction level event, something in which all of our butts are on the line, I feel like it would galvanize at least people doing what they believe is the right thing to do, like immediately. Like what you would see is a lot of, you know, for lack of a better term, grassroots movements for survivability.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's the issue right now with climate change is that there is the, you know, you get one side, you know, the extreme doomsayers that have made a lot of predictions out there that have just fallen totally flat and are not true, and we're pushing the limits of the science to one end, you know, and then the other end, people who are like, it's always changed, it's nothing's going to happen or whatever, we can't do anything. And I think that 7 billion organisms on top of a planet can contribute and can affect things in the short term. Long term, Earth is going to be fine. And it's that tendency that we feel like we have one's right or the other's right. Well, and it's not necessarily it's automatically the middle. You have to handle these things case by case. But I think that we certainly have had a bit of a burnout, you know, that, you know, we were 10 years ago, we were predicting, you know, many more hurricanes, which there's been intensity has increased in some areas. But, you know, along the eastern seaboard, we've had this dramatic quiet period in that. And that does not invalidate the overall thing, but it does make you go, well, you try to scare me with this thing, or you try to scare me with that, and that the danger of that is that then people tend to tune things out.
Yeah, we become inured to it. Even
when
like,
we shouldn't be.
Correct. In fact, World War II, there was this fantastic I'm probably wrong, but I think it was a Freakonomics episode. But they were talking about the psychology of going through bombings and about how there were pretty much only two categories of people who survived bombings. Or there were people who got hit by bombings, in which case they didn't complain. They weren't there because they were dead. And then there were people who survived them. And those people tended to have this irrational rush, and they were totally inured to bomb warnings afterwards. Kids would hear the air raid sirens and just keep playing because, you know, it's like, well, we've been through this five times. Nothing ever hits us. And then it's like, I mean, plus also it's like, I mean, what does it help to go to crawl under and, you know,
I mean,
be scared.
You kind of see that even in, you know, like fire alarms and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like, isn't like human nature after you hear, you know, 90,000 fire alarms from being a kid through being an adult that by the time that one goes off in your hotel room, you're just like, yeah, okay. Well, if it's still going in 10 minutes, then maybe I'll think about something.
Yeah. Like when I start smelling smoke, maybe I'll consider it. Like, meanwhile, it's like the hotel wants to scream, hey, we don't do false alarms. These are real. Go.
That's the danger, and that is the on one hand you have people who look at this data and are smarter than us, who see things that scare them very much because the punctualities, and you have other people who look at the data and go, yeah, but the recommendations we're making are going to be more damaging, and you know us in the middle going, all right, I'll try to buy an electric car when I can.
Speaking of that, a little not to do too much of a sideline, but a bit of a troublesome week for our favorite electric car company, Tesla. They had the Consumer Reports, which certainly is not the end all be all you know recommendation that it possibly once was or likes to consider themselves as, took the Model S out of their recommended category. And you've got some people from, you know, experts saying that their earnings announcement next week will not meet expectations, and they might be looking at, you know, long-term problems.
On the flip side, this week saw the beginning of a tidal wave. You saw the first of what will surely be many, many dramatic videos of cars on autopilot saving human lives. The video, if you haven't seen it, somebody cuts across traffic head on and the car just slams on the brakes and, save lives. If, a distracted human, may have missed. And, this by itself is not the single most dramatic, thing, but if the stories are only going to get better and the video is only more impressive.
Yeah, we had because we've had
also
a
seen the opposite
ago.
Though with the Tesla autopilot.
Like what?
Like the Tesla autopilot, like which is not again automated driving and should not be treated as automated driving. Where
what
you
was
know,
that
people...
headline we just saw?
Oh, this is a Consumer Reports headline that says reality check. It wasn't Tesla's autopilot that prevented the crash. Why does it say that?
I don't know. I didn't pull up the article, but
okay. Oh, it's basically they're pulling a this technology was already available in various other BMWs
okay. When there was we had 2 weeks ago we had when they first put out the update which had autopilot, we had some idiots that decided to try the limits of autopilot, including one guy that almost went into head-on traffic apparently because of it, because it may have been confused and he was using it outside what Musk said to do it with. I don't know what the short-term prospects are. I know what the long-term prospects are, is we're all going to be driving, almost all of us electric cars at some point. And Consumer Reports, came out and said, hey, we've looked at, the reliability of some of these, and they had questions about it, and they pulled the rating. Musk responded by saying these were some of the first cars to come off of the production line. We've solved these problems. I know I still want one, I think that they still seem like pretty amazing cars, and the pundits have been constantly battering Tesla for missed deadlines or everything like that. And there's a reason we haven't seen a new American car company in over half a century, because it's hard. And you can either step back and say, well, yeah, maybe short term things are going to be not steady and smooth as we'd like, but on the long term, nobody thought they would get this far. Nobody thought they would be at this point. That was far exceeded expectations. And by the everybody I talk to who has one, has driven one, absolutely loves this vehicle.
Well, and it's I mean, it just
I am a shareholder, by the way.
That seems like we should just I guess we do have to disclose that stuff of a trifling amount. These seem like Gen 1 issues. I was surprised that Consumer Reports gave it as high a rating as they did to begin with, to start.
But they,
I were to be media critic, hard to put on my skeptical media critic hat, I would also say that this is now the second time that Consumer Reports has decided to make a big dramatic reversal on something that also happens to get a lot of clicks and a lot of attention. They did this with the iPhone, and now they've done it with Tesla. And I'm not saying that it's not their right. They're allowed to do it. I'm not questioning, that their methodology. But if I were to be a skeptic, I think it's interesting that they've taken the tone that they have with these two things, which has led to such attention being brought to them.
And there was a quote that came up there, which Musk had said that 97% of Tesla owners said they would buy one again, which when you look at that is considered, the sort of the highest benchmark for customer satisfaction, which is one of the things that Apple champions too, is to say that, what percentage of their people like that. And we didn't know how to evaluate Apple because you never had a juggernaut like them and what they're able to do. We have trouble evaluating Tesla. You certainly can certainly be critical of the short term sales expectations, things like that. All of that's absolutely valid. But when it comes to the point of looking at this as a company that's in the next few years going to build the largest battery factory in the world and is going to try to scale in some unimaginable way and transform themselves in ways that be hard to understand. Open season to criticize, but man, we don't know the whole picture, And we talked about right before the show too, how there was a space journalist who was shown something at SpaceX that said that just was exceeded anything he could have, hoped to see. And we don't know what that is. And you know, this is the same brain, you know, behind Tesla is blowing the minds of space journalists with revelations that could, you know, that could range from the far hopeful, like, oh, it's maybe it's a new form of, you know, warp drive. No, no, it's not.
Yeah.
You know, to plans for a Martian city. Who knows?
So the other thing that in our Tesla corner that we can just address, Bob Lutz, a former vice chairman of General Motors, had a lot of critical things to say about Tesla, chief among them that amongst some of the Consumer Report stuff, that they don't have a legitimate advantage, you know, with their battery technology, and that other people can or other car companies can, you know, catch up to them based on the trail that they have blazed. What is not mentioned is that it seems unquestionable that we are in a world where Tesla is doing as well as it has. On-demand ride sharing is, you know, completely transformed what it's like to live in a city. And you know, you have companies like Google and Apple looking to possibly get in to, you know, cars, be they autonomous or otherwise, but certainly electric, that we are at a tipping point for automobiles, you know, that you know, quite possibly the rules of the last 50 years will matter slightly less than they have going forward. And some of Lutz's criticism, including, you know, the idea that company stores are a money pit, and that Tesla should be dealing with dealerships. You know, I don't quite see where a lot of that plugs in now.
Yeah, and, you know, this is a guy that was spearheading a company that had been trying to get into this space for years and years and years. And their first effort with the Volt was something like David Letterman joked, the thing couldn't even get to the end of the driveway without needing to recharge. And I'm sure now is probably a much more capable car. But I mean, it's a guy that if I was a guy that wanted to run a company like GM, which is, you know, 100-year institution, then that's probably the way I would be. But if I was trying to create an industry shift change, I would be thinking things differently. And, you know, IBM and Microsoft kind of laughed at Google in a sense. And then Google came about and certainly changed things when Jeff Bezos launched Amazon and was doing things in just totally the opposite the way you're supposed to do stuff. It kind of sort of worked. We've, you know, Apple building a phone, the phone company said, oh, what, a bunch of PC guys think they can walk in here and, you know, take over the phone market? Whoopsie. Looks like that happened. And, you know, the Mavericks rarely win, but when they do, they change the world.
I thought you meant the sports team, the Mavericks.
Yeah, no, it's Mark Cuban. Yeah, okay. We're totally talking about
it. Except for that one. I mean, they do rarely win, but when they do, it's the world championship.
Yeah. Hey, look at them. Congratulations to you, Mark Cuban. We would also like to implore you, since we have big upped your professional basketball team, to go ahead and send a few dollars our way. Go ahead on over to patreon.com/weirdthings, where everybody who would like to support the show can go ahead and chip us in a few dollars. We are very dependent on you guys helping out with this kind of stuff, and it makes sure that you get a brand new Piping Hot episode of Weird Things every single Sunday. Thank you guys for your support.
So, is it time for the Boba Fett story?
Yes! Yeah, I'm just going to say, I hope Andrew's not saying anything that doesn't say, so anyway, I was dressed as Boba Fett. Where do we first tease this? Just to set it up for anybody who doesn't know where we're... Did you mention this on Twitter? This happened between our two episodes, right?
Yeah, it happened on Wednesday.
Okay, so...
I got the call seconds after it happened, and it was so great to hear the already polished tall tale seconds after it happened.
Every detail is true, Brian.
I believe it. I believe
it. Every detail burned into my retina. So I'm not like a big Halloween guy, because kind of like Halloween sort of year-round for me. Last year, I bought a few Halloween costumes. Just like, oh, I'll just have them. So if I get called into something, so I bought my Captain America. I got the kind of the night. They sell pretty good, cheap but nice ones. Like, I bought an Captain America. Then I got a Winter Soldier one too, which was kind of cool. And I got a Boba Fett, which was, you know, kind of a cool Boba Fett. You know, it wasn't like the really, you know, authentic type. And I got the good helmet, not the half don't suffocate in this helmet. So I got the good helmet and I put it away. And then this year, I'm like, man, you're like, I kind of got a lot of work to do. I really don't want to go out for Halloween or do anything. But you know what? Wednesday, Magic Castle. Magic Castle has their members night party. I'm like, I'll go to that, you know, bring a friend. And so I'm getting some work done last minute, racing to get done before I have to get my car. And I look, I got like almost no time. Like, well, it's fine. I go pop on the Boba Fett costume, grab the helmet. Everything's great. Get in my car and I go look at my gas gauge. Almost zero. It's like no gas in the tank. All right, it's fine. Pull up to the gas station. I'll get out of the car as Boba Fett, middle of, you know, Hollywood Boulevard, Hollywood Way in Burbank, California. Rush hour. It's now a rush hour. Cars everywhere. So I'm get out to pump Slave One full of gas. And there's the people kind of just standing there looking at, like, because the Boba Fett thing kind of looks maybe like sort of like pajamas or something too. And I don't have the jetpack. So there I am, like, pumping
gas. Plus, it's not like it's Halloween night. You know, this is the Wednesday beforehand.
Yeah.
Although, to argue against that, it is Los Angeles. Like, yeah, there's really no guarantee that at any point there is somebody looking to get gas in a Boba Fett costume.
Yeah. So, you know, pumping gas in Boba Fett. And I said, you know what? I'm going to take a photo of this. So I take the helmet out of the car, and I take out my phone, and I make this photo, this sort of grumpy face, because I've got to – got to pump Slave One full of gas. I'm like, all right, at least I got a funny photo out of it, right? And there's the photo of it.
Oh, right on.
So I get back in my car, and man, it's get on the Hollywood Way. It's kind of tricky
that photo.
Because there's a lot of traffic going one way, and so you kind of got to turn around and then go do a U-ey, you know, in through traffic. It's a little bit hair-raising. Not like navigating an asteroid field while you're chasing after, you know, Millennium Falcon or whatever. So I pull onto the road, step on the gas, and I hear thump, thump, thump on the roof.
Like that Starbucks on the roof experience that we've all done of leaving our sodas or whatever.
I look in my rearview mirror, and what do I see? I see a head floating, rotating past the windshield, down into the street. See, the Boba Fett helmet, I left it on top of the car, so now it's rolling across the street right into traffic. Okay. And I tell you that, does time slow down at these points? Yes, because I have a flashback to a horrible Star Wars prequel scene where Jango Fett, you know, loses his head. And young Boba, it was like, I watched my clone father die all over again as I watched my head roll into traffic.
So you immediately just slam on the brakes.
Brian, I'm at that point where I'm like, do I just go? Do I just leave the scene? You know, and
is that now community Boba Fett head? You know, I have just given it back to the city.
Well, if I slam the brakes, do I cause an accident or whatever? Well, there was a car that was like, I had to try and turn before another car made this turn on the intersection. That car came to a stop. Okay, it came to a stop as my head goes rolling there, and so I see my headlight, my Boba Fett helmet reflecting the headlights now sitting there in the middle of traffic, like, now or never. Pop the car into park. I pop out of the car and I start running. Now,
By the way, thank goodness that you put it in park, because in those patterned interruption moments are when you stop and you get out and forget that it's still in drive.
I've definitely done that.
Yeah.
God forbid. So it's just got nicer out here. The weather is really nice. So people coming home from work, everybody decides to have their window rolled down, you know, enjoy the California weather. That's why I live here. So there I am running across the street in my full Boba Fett uniform. I hear cackles of laughter from everywhere as people see the idiot who just stopped his car in traffic and is now running back into the middle of the street to go grab his Boba Fett helmet. I go grab my Boba Fett helmet. I look up and I just see people staring at me, smiling, grinning, because they got the story to tell about the idiot.
Yeah.
So I run back to my car and I just go, of course this would happen. Duh, have to happen to me, right? You know, and I get in my car and I'm like, I'm that guy.
That's awesome.
I'm the guy. I'm that idiot. I'm that, like, oh,
would
I
the
saw
story
the dumbest
be,
guy today.
Would so. The story be any better if everybody recognized you as TV's Don't Trust Andrew Maine? like
your craziest prank yet.
I don't know. So there you go.
That is amazing. That is just an amazing visual. Just go back. Yeah, look, it's the face. Like, if that's where you started, you know,
and it only got better from there.
And then I go to the Magic Castle and I'm telling people, like, yeah, I dropped my helmet. They're looking at the damage, the pre-existing damage. They go, oh my gosh, that dent's really. I'm like, no, that's actually from the movie. That's part of it. It's supposed to look like this.
That's just the scars of being a Mandalorian. No.
Well, as long
Happy
as we're
Halloween,
talking about,
ever. That's why I didn't go out last night. Instead, I went and saw The Martian.
As long as we're watching, did you finally just see it for the first time? Do you want to chat about it now, or
should we save that for the end?
Yeah, let's
save for the end.
Okay,
save for the end.
Did you guys see the interview? The wonderfully titled Harrison Ford answers questions about Star Wars while dressed like a hot dog on the Jimmy Kimmel Show.
I saw the headline. I didn't actually watch it.
It's pretty great. He looks jolly. The 73-year-old Harrison Ford does. And by jolly, you know, he might have had a drink or two or something. he might be a little relaxed.
Which, by the way, you know, Jimmy Kimmel, for whatever reason, has been able to get Harrison Ford to kind of do these sort of wacky things that he, you know, has as being, you know, a fairly, you know, thought of to be a bit grumpy, especially about being defined by some of his previous roles. You know, he seems to have been reticent to do before, but this was right around the time that they were initially even, this might have even been before the sale maybe it was after the sale of Star Wars or Lucasfilm to Disney, where Jimmy Kimmel got him to answer questions, but he was, you know, but the bit was the existing precondition that he was putting on last minute was that none of it could be about Star Wars, which ended with a tremendous gag with Chewbacca. But Kimmel's had such great luck with him.
Yeah. Well, he actually seems really positive. I mean, I'm sure, you know, it's his freaking job, right, to go out and promote the movie. But he's also, you know, he's got that reputation as being kind of a surly, a bit cynical when he thinks about Han Solo. But instead, I mean, he was just saying the nicest things about the movie, which if you can get Harrison Ford to actually go out and get excited enough to go out and plug it dressed as a hot dog. But more accurately, he's dressed as a dog wearing a hot dog outfit.
Yeah, he's got a dog like snout on him in a hot dog costume, for which I am familiar with because it's the one we have at the Go Game.
I immediately recognized it as well. That's amazing. But he, yeah, man, it, again, cautiously optimistic. And it's so funny because after the prequels, man, the bar to beat is so low. Like, just be better than any of the prequels, and I'll be so, so happy. And I'm cautiously optimistic that it'll do much, much more.
There was actually another great video that Andrew sent me where Vanity Fair got a bunch of people to ask J.J. Abrams questions.
Oh, that's right. And he didn't know what they were beforehand.
Didn't know what they were or who was asking them. Which included a clip from George Lucas asking whatever happened to Darth Jar Jar Vader's grandchildren.
Yeah. Oh,
Darth
yeah.
Vader's grandchildren.
Darth Vader's grandchildren, that's right. wait, is that because is that a reference to the expanded universe being wiped away as part of the Disney acquisition?
It is all that. It is whatever, yeah, you know, has been talked about Vader's grandchildren in the past, whatever will happen, you know, if Vader has grandchildren in JJ's version of the universe, you know, we will all find out. But I think it is George Lucas trying to ask the most needling, nerdsome question for which he has made a lifetime of getting asked, now being able to use that dagger to stab somebody.
Now you get to be like, ask JJ.
Hey,
ask JJ.
I have to do an about face and I have to eat some crow. I was during the Disney acquisition when they officially announced, like, here are the rules. All the books are all apocryphal. None of them count. Blah, blah, blah. Expanded universe. I was one of the really butthurt crowd that was like, man, they worked so hard to be so consistent. They were so good. And yet I am now tasting the sweet fruits of that, which is, if they hadn't done that, if that Band-Aid got ripped off, and it was very painful for me at the time. But the gift I have now is genuinely not having any idea what's coming up. I have a genuine mystery and a blank canvas, which is an experience that I haven't had until before, you know, the Phantom Menace. And this one is much, much more likely to pay off.
Well, I look forward to Jara Maid and Admiral Prawn.
Which, I mean, because that does work both ways. Because if
you know, let's say theoretically that, you know, they want to bring back one of those characters, or they do find that there is a place in the universe for those characters, it would be a tremendous moment, you know, where you could, and also you would not know exactly where they go or where they end. You know, Admiral Thrawn, for as fantastic of a character as he is, kind of goes out like a real sucker. Like, you know, it's
but like, meanwhile, it's can you imagine if out in the reaches of the new empire or whatever they're calling it, I have no idea. But you just get one character, turn it around, and you see those glowing blue eyes. Like, I mean, I would go nuts because we were told not on the menu, and then all of a sudden they bring out a birthday cake and they're singing copyright free happy birthday songs for you.
Well, no, you can do that now.
I know.
Wasn't that the thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And instead of for he's a jolly good fellow.
Yeah. Happy birthday. We made it to the song and we all sing it. So you will sing along.
So do we want to jump right into a Martian discussion now?
Yeah. I can't believe.
All right. So here we go. Do we want to do picks before Martian? So people who want to remain pure, like we can just put the Martian at the end so they can just stop listening.
All right. I got a very tepid, lukewarm pick for you guys, but I'm doing it, and so I'll encourage you guys to do it with me. On Netflix, the first season of The Flash is on, and so that's been my, while I'm playing Hearthstone, turn on some noise in the background.
It's such a fun show.
It is. I mean, if you remember what it is and what network it's on, and what it, and for some reason, I think. Just like some movies get an upgrade when you see them on the small screen for free on HBO compared to, you know, buying a ticket and sitting there in a darkened theater with your full attention. You know, when I saw back in the 90s, there is this movie, Multiplicity, with Michael Keaton, that I hated at the movie theater, but I thought was cute when I saw it on HBO again later. I think that The Flash gets an upgrade.
You got Keaton, bro. Out of Keaton.
Yeah.
Spot to any movie.
He got... at any rate, I think this gets an upgrade for being on Netflix and being free and being bingeable, you know, while you could just keep it in a window doing something else.
I think it's the best broadcast or cable superhero show there's probably ever been. I'm leaving, you know, obviously Netflix and Daredevil as a side because that's a Netflix thing, but I think that they found...
Better than Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., even though that's got the Marvel tie-in? Okay, I'm going to take that as
audio listeners, to understand that the creeping Cheshire cat grin of Andrew.
That's the sound of his brain short-circuiting from too much frustration with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Listen, the same people told me it got better, the same people told me Heroes got better, and then, you know, and then Heroes came back, you know, so... I think it's a fun show. I think that, like, I liked Arrow a bit, but Arrow got a little bit too soap opera for me. But this was, like, I didn't finish the first season, still a few episodes behind. But I just said, oh, this is, like, they're writing this kind of show, I think, to the best that you could write this kind of show. And it was, you know, there's certainly a lot of, you know, the comic book sort of logic things. But I like that the casting was great. That was really
cool. That's one of the things that's
so
kind of
fun, that in television – Marvel and DC, or at least their properties, have kind of diverged in opposite patterns than the movies, where in the movies, DC has rightfully kind of gotten dinged for being so over-serious and so dour, and Marvel has redefined what a franchise is by making these action, light, fun, comedy, you know, infused films. And in television, DC... You know, Supergirl, which is a lot of the same. Is it the same producers as did Flash and Arrow that, you know, they debuted to really big numbers on CBS?
I think so.
You know, that they've made a franchise of being, hey, look, superhero shows should be fun and we should have likable characters and we should put them in fun situations and you know, it should resolve at the end. Whereas Daredevil, if you look, I mean, you know.
Wait, back up. You just skipped over the bigger TV franchise Marvel has.
Bigger than...
Hey, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yes.
Well, all right.
I love this version of things, and I was seeking this thing, but no, like, yeah, the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is a totally different planet.
Well, and real quick, weirdly, the cheapness of the effects, you know the mid-level television, you know, CGI that you see kind of gives a rubberized look to everything that just makes me forgive kind of the campy writing, the recaps coming back from commercial breaks, the re-explanations, you know, like you would get in a procedural show of you know, someone casually mentioning, like, I know that you were blasted with a lightning bolt and now you have superpowers that make you go incredibly fast, but don't patronize me, you know. So that's, I don't know, all of that writing somehow just it wears better on this show.
Oh, sure. And you're right, because Peggy Carter and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. are both, you know, for whatever their varying qualities, certainly a more lighthearted kind of fare. But for what their Netflix programming is, you know, with Daredevil being very serious and amazing and awesome. But, you know, you see the trailer for
Jessica Jones.
It's like, oh my God, like this is like, you know, David Lynch level, like, you know, bizarre.
Or, you know, Peggy Carter, which I enjoyed, you know, where it's like, oh, will she get caught sneaking in late to the all women's dorm? You know, your Jessica Jones looks like she just woke up from a one night stand, is drunk.
Yeah, just like, you know, heavy, you know, multiple swinging corpses, you know, in your like a minute and a half introduction to the character. Just, yeah, pretty heavy, Doc, but fun stuff all around.
What about you guys?
My pick is, in the spirit of space adventures and stuff, is Capricorn One. If you ever see Capricorn One?
I don't think I have.
I'm so familiar with it, but I've not seen it.
The 1970s, very disillusioned after Watergate, and this, the realization that sometimes government has these conspiracies and does these things that are counter-interest and disillusionment of the Vietnam War, comes a movie called Capricorn One, directed by Peter Hyams, starring Elliot Gould, James Brolin, and even Orenthal J. Simpson.
Wow.
They are astronauts about to embark on a Mars mission, and right as they're being led to get into the capsule, there's a knock on the door and opens up, and the mission director says, hey guys, come with me. We got to talk. And it's basically a conspiracy that the government had to fake a Mars mission, and these guys are told they're supposed to keep their mouths shut, but they don't want to.
Now, do you think that this is possibly, like, I wonder how, whether, were there moon hoaxers during the moon landing?
This probably inspired a lot of the contemporary moon hoax. It probably inspired a lot of it because it was a, this was made, you know, and the thing to think about too is that, like, in the, you know, the last time we put a man on the moon was like 1973. So this movie came out 4 years later, 5 years later. At that time, nobody was really doubting it because it was, you know,
and the moon hoaxers
had to regress to the first one was faked.
Yeah.
The other ones, we went the other times because it was just, it was like, yeah, maybe, oh, did we go? Like, we went a lot, guys. We didn't just go once. You know, we had several missions to the moon. And that was like, in the 70s, it was hard to think that it was faked because it was, you know,
happening.
Yeah, it happened. And they touch upon this here. They go like, oh, you know, the last time we went to the moon, you know, people complained that, you know, this was on TV when they want to watch something else or whatever. And so this movie is credited with having actually influenced moon hoaxers and stuff because they have sound stages that look like Mars and everything else. So but remember, too, there was also a scene in Diamonds Are Forever, which was 1972, where you have Sean Connery trying to track down the villains. They go through Willard White, who's a loose analog of Howard Hughes. They go through his space research facilities, and you see astronauts fake, you know, on the moon as they're shooting some sort of, are there maybe testing equipment? Or are they faking it? We don't quite know.
That's funny. So how long did this last? Was it a TV series? Was it a
movie? It was a movie. It was just a movie.
Okay.
And it's actually got, you know, it's got mixed, it's actually got some really cool sort of action sequences and survival stuff. I enjoyed it. I'd seen it, you know, as a kid on TV, like on Saturday mornings, but then I watched it all the way through last week and actually said, no, this is a pretty solid movie.
Awesome.
And Elliot Gould, who was in every movie in the 70s for a period of time.
Dude, that is, and also like in the pantheon of great conspiracy movies. Right. Mm-hmm. Like every once in a while, for whatever reason, that you can never really do a bunch together. you know, but like, you know, the really awesome, like everyone's in on it that aren't like based on real things. Conspiracy movies can often be so fun because it's such a rich genre of like, all right, what would be so awesome or so worth it that you would have to get over 50 people in on something, you know, and hoodwink other people. And you get such awesome plots like Capricorn One or Manchurian Candidate and stuff like that, where it's super rad. All right. I'm going to pick a movie that came out a while ago. I saw it yesterday at this awesome theater in Oakland called the New Parkway that does a lot of old movies. It's a little film called The Ghostbusters.
So that's the old Filmation 1977 comic book, right? Or
live action. They made a live action.
Wait, version. I think that was a old, like, was that an Abbott and Costello sketch? Or what am I thinking of?
It was definitely, you know, there's definitely an old Mickey Mouse cartoon where they sell the services of they call themselves like the Ghost Exterminators. And it's Donald and Mickey and some other and Goofy, and it's just the Ghostbusters. And I was like, holy cow, how did I see this for the first time?
Well, but Brian, the history of that is there was, like I just said, there was actually way before then, there was like one of these old time, and I forget which comedy group there was, like, that did one of these things. And a lot of those Disney cartoons were sort of parodies, we'll say, like Steamboat Willie, yeah. You know, was actually was based on
the line, you know.
Steamboat was the what's his name, the not Harold Lloyd, but one of the actors, hold on,
oh geez, I don't know, I would be there for you if I knew what you were referencing.
Cartoons have a rich history though of just dead ripping, you know, stuff like that, that, you know, it's like for whatever reason in that era.
Steamboat Bill Jr. It was a parody of Buster Keaton, Steamboat Bill Jr.
Got it. And by parody, it's just pretty much a note for note retelling of it.
I mean, it was just its own, you know, take on that. So if we go back to, there was the Ghostbusters, a 1970s live action series. Oh, 1946 Spookbusters. A Bowery Boys film.
Oh, interesting. So
the working
that's
title of it was Ghostbusters.
Huh.
And remember when they had to call it the real Ghostbusters because there was another Ghostbusters cartoon?
Well, and the reason they couldn't fight it was because they licensed the name Ghostbusters for the live action movie from Filmation, because Filmation had it. And then once it became this giant phenomenon, they're all like, crank up the Ghostbusters franchise. And then they came out with it and they couldn't stop them because
there was the 1975 TV series, which the cartoon was based on, where actually had the gorilla and all that. So if you look up, so.
Exactly.
So watching the Ghostbusters yesterday, a couple things kind of stuck out. Number one, you know, and especially and this is something that, you know, Andrew and I kind of talk a lot about, but like the difference between plot and story, you know, there is a very simple story to Ghostbusters and a very complicated and interesting and well-told and explained plot. Like the idea of, you know, that the ghosts exist, you know. And you never, but you know, in how awesome a movie it is, you realize so much of it is eliminating other things that another movie might have done that takes away from what we really love about this story. There's never a main character that doubts the existence of ghosts. You know, there's a lot of noise around it. Of like they're scam artists, they're snowball artists, you know, they're faking things. But that's always on the periphery. None of the main three are like, well, I don't know. Maybe this is something. Is that what I just think it was?
Even though the opening scene shows a very jaded Peter Venkman, you know, falsifying his results as he administers this test to get in the girl's pants.
It's something I never noticed about, you know, and we were talking last week about story arcs or character arcs rather, in Back to the Future. That, you know, based on you know, I guess Dan Harmon saying that there was that Marty McFly didn't have a character arc in the first Back to the Future.
And he hated 2 and 3.
Or in 2 and 3.
No, he hated 2 and 3.
He hated 2 and 3. That's fine. So I never really thought of like, okay, so what's Venkman's character arc? And it never really struck me until watching it yesterday, because his character arc is like him controlling his libido. And there was a moment that I never really, and that is like the subjugation of his charisma for the team, and his care for Sigourney Weaver is, you know, there's this scene that where she is inhabited by Zool, spoiler alert, you know, she's like throwing herself at him and she flies and everything. And then they call, or he's on the phone with Egon or Spengler, I forget. And they have this slow pan of her sleeping and all these clothes on the floor. And I never really put two and two together that that is kind of there to almost make you think that this guy who was probably only a college professor to sleep with students and, you know, was letting his wiener lead him around, even in dealing with that, maybe wasn't taking the fridge haunting as seriously in one of their first cases.
Right.
That now, as it pans over to him, he's fully dressed and says, oh, no, she's asleep because I gave her a tranquilizer. And so that's why she's asleep. But like that initial shot is kind of there to set up, oh, my God, did he have sex with her? Like oh, that Venkman. But then the there's this character moment for him that, like, no, I actually put something above my desire to sleep with this pretty lady for the sake of the team and for her, that it's too far to sleep with somebody who is possessed, even for Venkman. But so awesome. And, man, Slimer looks amazing. Like, it is insane how good Slimer is. Well, absolutely inverse to how terrible the Zool dog looks, especially when chasing down Rick Moranis.
Oh, well, because it's the difference between stop motion animation, you know, which has not aged well, whereas just puppetry. I mean, we haven't gotten much better at puppetry than we were back then, you know, and that's just a, you know, simple translucent overlay. It looks, I'm sure Slimer looks way better than any kind of CGI version we've seen since.
You know, maybe now I'd be curious to see what they, you know, and I'm sure they'll bring back Slimer for the new version of Ghostbusters. But, you know, it looked so good. And I'll also say this. Bill Murray obviously, you know, owns that movie. Rick Moranis might be as funny as Bill Murray.
Oh, dude, he was my favorite character. Anything Rick Moranis did was the best. Their movie Strange Brew is the I watched probably more times. That's right.
Prime of his powers, but like, gosh darn it, if every time he doesn't go to that door and find it locked, and like, it is about like as slapsticky as one could get, you know, but like the you know, that he, and it's a fairly complicated comedic role for him too, because he has to be kind of unlikable enough that you understand that Sigourney Weaver doesn't have pity for him,
right?
So it's kind of a pest. He's kind of not a terrible guy, but, you know, he's sort of, you know, odd to the point where, you know, but yet he has to be lovable enough that he gets put in these situations and you kind of feel good for him when he eventually does, under the power of, you know, a gozer.
Demon. Sure.
You know, he does, as Vince Clortho off screen, kind of consummate a relationship with the gatekeeper. So, you know, it's a fairly complicated comedic role. He's so good. And that movie's amazing. And I'm really excited to see the remake.
I think a big part of why that movie works is because Dan Aykroyd is absolutely insane. And yeah. Aykroyd, I love Aykroyd, and he's brilliant. He's a guy that believes in UFOs, he believes in aliens, and he's a super smart guy. And so this movie just sort of says, well, we're not going to get into like, yeah, the level two ET, of course these things are real, you know? So anyhow.
Well, and it's funny because that's why it reads with this authenticity, this gravitas, is because he's, you know, this is his chance to, it's almost as though that's what makes it so funny, is that you could tell either, you know, either he's the most brilliant actor you've ever seen, or he really does believe this because he speaks it with such, you know, earnestness. And, you know, I don't know. I love it.
Similar to that, Sneakers. His role in Sneakers, the Robert Redford film, wherein he basically plays himself as a conspiracy nut who, you know, is constantly trying to inform everybody how, you know,
there were brief moments in Hacking the System that there were segments that they had written like, oh, talk about the Barnum Effect or whatever. And it slipped into, it was close enough to material that I had done for 10 years in the skeptical lecture that was super polished. And you could see me suddenly speaking completely extemporaneously, rattling off facts and figures and all this stuff. And I have to imagine that's what those moments are like for Dan Aykroyd, where it's like, and then for this 30 seconds, just be yourself and talk from the heart. And we'll call that acting.
The three principal actors are so good. And yeah, the other thing that kind of hit me in watching it, and this will be my final thought, is it really is this kind of movie. I mean, remember when it came out, this is the early 80s, the idea of New York was closer to Detroit than London at the point that this movie came out. And there are all these themes of like, I love this city, and look at like all these New York kind of moments, and this is New York pulling together, and this is like, you know, a entrepreneurial bootstrap, you know, kind of thing that very much has this feel of like, hey, there's something good about New York, and even if your Superman is obviously speaking with a Chicago accent in Peter Venkman, it's very much a love letter to that city at a time that, you know, it feels like the people that were writing it felt that it needed it.
I live right across the street from where they did the Central Park scenes in front of the building.
Oh, that's awesome. With the marshmallow fluff.
Mm-hmm. Where they put the crowd scenes and the earthquake and all that.
That's awesome.
So last night I went and saw The Martian.
Yeah. So if you don't want to hear Martian spoilers, turn the stupid thing off. Sorry.
See you later, jerks. I think it's fair to say going into this, you couldn't finish the book, right? Because it was too procedural. It was just,
I remembered why when I first started the book and I'm like, oh, I'm confused here. And then I saw the movie. I'm like, oh yeah, that's the thing that kind of got me that it wasn't like, oh, a deal breaker, but it's like, nah, this isn't what I thought it would be. Maybe I'll read it some other time. And then, you know, I thought like, oh man, like if I want to see this. If I want to go see The Martian and the AMC Prime, the really nice thing, probably now's the time because they're going to put Spectre in that theater next week. So I figured, you know what, go see Martian. And it looks like it's Ridley Scott's most successful domestic film ever.
Wow.
Reviews have been great. Audiences love it. It's been doing great. I think it's absolutely a great thing for science fiction and space films and stuff. And to do a movie about Mars where it's not like, and then we find aliens, you know?
Yeah.
It is great. I thoroughly enjoyed the film. I thoroughly enjoyed the film, and I absolutely encourage anybody who's not seen it to go see it. Okay, let me make that very, very, very clear. Okay, very, very clear. And I'm not one of these people that's like, well, there's this thing and this thing, therefore I declare, you know, I that you know, therefore this movie failed. No, I was driven nuts by several things, and I was confused by them.
Okay, now keep in mind, before you go into them. Do you have a sense of why these types of things would make you nuts on The Martian and didn't make you nuts on Gravity? Because, you know, obviously there's a number of inconsistencies scientifically in Gravity that I would
say the ones in Gravity are far overblown.
Okay.
Gravity was a far more logical film than this was.
Right on.
And we've gone by point, a famous astronomer whom I respect quite a lot, who was wrong on a number of his points about gravity. Like, oh, this isn't true. Like, no, that's actually, satellites aren't in this orbit. No, there are a lot of low Earth orbit satellites. All, you know, why is a doctor working on the Hubble? Well, actually, it's a doctor fixed the Hubble the last time it was broke, you know, so and whatever the technical things, you know, and I think you can make certain leaps. You can say we're going to present this thing like that, but then you've got to be consistent about that. And that's sort of what got me sort of nuts.
Yeah.
So people like, you got to read The Martian, like technically it's great. I'm like, wow, let me listen to this. And then I realized at the very beginning, like he got buried because of a windstorm on Mars. And I'm like, that does not compute. A windstorm on, you know, 60 mile an hour winds on Mars, it has 1% the atmosphere of Earth. It barely feels like a gentle breeze. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I thought in the book, I have to imagine Andy Weir got, I mean, there are on Mars winds of sufficient force to blow rocks around, right?
No, well, they blow dust around. You don't, you're not going to get the toppling kind of things that they have in here, which you don't. It does. That's the Martian winds are, even at the highest speeds, it might feel like a 20 mile an hour wind on Earth. That's the highest you're going to feel because it's 1% atmosphere. So at the beginning, I'm watching this windstorm like, wow, you know, if you've seen Prometheus or Alien, you know Ridley loves his alien planet windstorms and he does them great. But I'm going, this is not a real thing that would happen on the Mars that I know. And I'm watching debris, this thick stuff fly by, and the stuff that coats the solar. And then you're like, but like, wow, there are craters and stuff that haven't eroded away. And then you see, you know, the stuff that covers the solar panels, by the way, is particulate that's about the size of cigarette smoke dust.
Yeah, you know? And you know what? It says it is very much correct. The max surface wind speed was 12 meters per second. I think the Viking only saw up to 60 miles an hour. So it looks like 125 miles an hour is the max. Gusts can reach 300 to 375 miles per hour.
Yes, but it's 1% the air pressure, Brian.
Right. Yeah. Huh. All right.
So I'm like, okay, this is a version of Mars that's not like Mars. Okay, I'm like, I'm okay with that kind of thing.
Well, especially since like the Martian soil itself is poison. It's got, I forget what it is in there, but it's got something so deadly that we don't even know how to pull it out, and we will never grow anything in Martian soil, and we can't even figure out.
We might say there could be different kinds of soil, but like, yeah, the soil is so fine, we don't even know how to make it that fine, like on Earth. But like, it's like I said, it's like cigarette smoke is how fine parts of it are. But I could make allowance, like, oh, but we could discover this other thing. But when you're talking about this, you're like, oh, the winds are so powerful.
That's what it was. Perchlorate is the stuff in the dust that makes it to where we can't use it to grow anything.
Yeah, but we don't. But I'm a guy that I'm an apologist for movies. Like, I will be like, but if we had a crater or something that unearthed other stuff, whatever, maybe it's different. You know, if there was something that, you know. So, but it was the wind thing. Like, this is kind of because, like, and so I'm like a bit annoyed by that, but I'm like, all right, just go with it. But then they come back to it later on, spoiler alert, when he's going to take off, and they're like, we need you to take off the nose cone, you know.
Oh, they're like, don't worry about going 500 miles an hour because the atmosphere is so thin.
But he's to reach an intercept velocity, he's got to be going like 25,000 miles an hour.
Right.
Okay. So how much of that's in the thin atmosphere? So it's like, wait, you want to have it thick for this, you know, and then you're going to have it thin for making the survival. As you explain how we can survive this.
You would probably go even more nuts in the book because they cut out of the movie a whole chunk where as he's going from his original site to where the Ares IV lander is, there's a gigantic dust storm that he has to triangulate, but because the gigantic dust storm essentially just manifests itself as a slightly reduced, you know, slightly dimmer sky or whatever, he has to lay out miles and miles and miles apart all these different solar collectors so that he can get data and sort of triangulate which one is getting the most amount of sunlight to figure out which direction to go. So it's like now you have a third vector where it's like the storm where explicitly storms cannot be bad enough to even be noticed.
Can darken, you know, the sky certainly darkens from weather and stuff like that. We've seen that. So that variability there. And then, you know, the plastic tarp airlock kind of thing was weird. And the amount of radiation this guy's getting through all this is like, man, that's the thing that's going to kill you is that. So the conveniences annoyed me. Like, oh yeah, by the way, you know, there's an effing spaceship over here. Yeah, we didn't mention that before. We launched it before because, you know, to have it ready. Even though our last one just got knocked over almost in a space thing, you know, space storm, it's why I had to leave. It's like, all right. You know, it's like there's just this, you know, these moments, they don't need to be there. They could be differently. Like if you wanted to have a catastrophe on Mars, a freaking carbon dioxide vent, you know, or – you know, if you read the research, you knew there was water on Mars when this book was written, but Weir didn't put that in there because it hadn't been like formally announced. So, you know, we know there was more water, and he, Weir, if he wrote it now, he says he would do it differently. This guy's way smarter than I am. Let me make that very clear. Way knows way more about Mars than I will ever know. But there were choices made that were just sort of like, why did we do it this way? And then it just, you know, the radiation alone was just driving me nuts. Just the idea that, you know, how much radiation you would get through like this thin plastic veneer. It's like you're on an, you're his side of his space habitat is, it's like having plastic in front of you in Antarctica, you know.
Right.
You're going to freeze to death, you know, unless that's so. Despite all that,
And not to be an apologist, but not in the book, that tarp thing, that tarp okay. was a visual that they did just on the movie.
Yeah. And so, and then, you know, enter Corey Glover's like, I've got a brilliant idea. I'm like, man, I'm going to be so excited if this doesn't involve an orbital assist. I'm going to be so excited to hear something that's not the sneaky, how do we go faster in 2010 in every other science fiction film where you need to pick up velocity. Wait for it. Oh, okay. Yeah. He does. You stand there. It's a horrible. Right. But this is we get this. This is the go-to, you know. So I was a little did I say Corey Glover? Hilarious.
Glover.
With one of the Glovers, his son. Still enjoyed it. I still thought it was fun. I really, really thought it was fun. You know, as a writer who likes science, I'm like, you know, you could have equally exciting things that are a little more accurate or whatever, but you know, most people don't care, and that's fine. And I think it's a fine movie. I think it's a fine movie for the purposes of science and science fiction. I think it's a really well done, you know, character thing. I thought it was really, really enjoyable, and I really liked it. Those things drove me nuts, but I can forgive them for how well put together it was. And the production design was fantastic. You know, having that crew work with you on Prometheus and other films has certainly paid in dividends, where it just felt really nice and cool and real and stuff. So go see The Martian, because I have absolutely no problem with it whatsoever and think it's a perfect film.
it's definitely interesting to hear that that perspective, because it has definitely gotten the reputation as being like, especially, and God knows why we feel the need to pit it against Gravity, like that we can't just have.
How lucky we are to have two great films about space, we can about have aliens. Science.
Well, and I, you know, that I doesn't would include aliens and ray guns. You know, that we can't just love these things. And Interstellar as well.
What I was going to bring up.
Well, but it's also.
But that one has
for whatever reason has been pitted against Gravity more, because it has gotten the reputation as being, well, Gravity played fast and loose with the science, and The Martian, you know, was a textbook, which is odd. But it is interesting to hear that perspective, that, you know, Martian took liberties. Because for me, I have no idea. I certainly am not the one watching that movie and saying, but the atmosphere, you know. But it's interesting to hear, you know, and I'm curious to see other.
Yeah, my thing was like at the beginning, I'm like, all right, just accept that that's the way Mars is. But then later on in the movie, they decide to ignore that and go against that. You know, that was my problem. Was like, there's an inconsistency. Mars is either this place with this really, really high speed winds that can knock you over, knock satellite dishes into and impale you. Or Mars is a place where you can launch a rocket off the surface with a tarp over the top, because you don't have to worry about going, you know, reaching 25,000 miles an hour or whatever, you know, your Martian velocity needs to be, and not being blown to smithereens and incinerated to death, which is what would happen if it was just that inconsistent. It's like, make up your mind and you can make it work. You can make it work without it getting boring. And there's so many cool hazards on Mars, carbon dioxide flumes and things like that. And, you know, you could have had an avalanche of like unstable surface and whatever and been buried under there. And you would have had the same effect and not had to get into the issue. And the winds made a dramatic thing. I get that, you know, but it's kind of
And the winds are in the book, right? Unless I'm misremembering.
Yeah, that's how it starts. That's what drove me nuts about the book was when I first read it was I got buried underneath the Martian winds. I'm like, is this Edgar Rice Burroughs? Like, that's not going to happen. And, you know, and so I'm like, all right, go read it when you don't want to, because it was pitched to me as like, this, wow, this really cool hard science fiction thing. And it is, many points it is, but if I went into it with a different frame of mind, you know, I had to get it, took me 3 times to get into Harry Potter, and then I loved it, you know.
Yeah. Wow, that's like alternate,
magic.
That's alternate universe versions of Andrew Vane. I'm here, and that's amazing. I would have liked to have known you during that time.
I didn't dislike it, but you read the first part of Harry Potter, it's like a Roald Dahl. You know, it's all about Uncle Vernon and the weirdos in the streets and stuff. It's not like the cool parts, you know.
So. That's amazing.
So there you go. Again, I'm a guy that I can see these things and see these flaws and still love and enjoy something and go, oh, but still, it was a really fun, enjoyable movie. I liked it. I'll buy it when it comes out on iTunes. I'll have it. I'll watch it again, and I'll cringe less and just, you know.
Yeah. Well, cool, man.
Awesome.
All right.
I guess that's it.
Boys, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.